perhaps a major reconstitution. The communists, greens, and socialists are deciding whether or not to join forces behind Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who finished third in the presidential race. Should they unite for the June legislative elections, they could deny Macron absolute control of parliament and thus drastically change his plans for his second term.
I can't recall the last time people felt they were actually voting for someone rather than voting to eliminate something. But not everyone here accepts this logic of reformism. We workers who produce the wealth need to prove an alternative to this system, like the Yellow Vests do, through consciousness and organization.
Unions, notably quiet during the presidential campaign, were out in big numbers, though far from records. Police, normally elbow to elbow with protesters at Yellow Vest demonstrations, gave marchers plenty of room, with few serious confrontations reported. May Day 2019 is often considered the end of the major Yellow Vest demonstrations. Hundreds of arrests, warrantless searches starting from a 150-kilometer radius around Paris, and massive police violence gutted the average person's willingness to join 6 months of enormous anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
People in the Gaza Strip mark this year's Eid al-Fitr holiday for the 16th time under the Israeli blockade. The joyful occasion comes at the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Traditionally, Muslims go to markets several days before Eid to buy gifts, new clothes, and sweets for their loved ones, but many here can't afford that because of the high unemployment and poverty rates. United Nations figures show that 80% of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been relying on handouts in recent years in order to survive.
I'm having a very hard time while trying to buy new clothes for the holiday. I'm on a very tight budget, and I really don't know how to get through this holiday. There is hardly any money in Gaza, and the situation is only getting worse day after day.
For Gazan families, it has been a very tough task to buy Eid items for their children amid the harsh economic situation in the besieged coastal enclave. People scour the markets for hours to try and find affordable gifts for their families.
Most Gazans are broke and can't buy Eid items for their families. Gifts and clothes are very expensive, but we're determined to celebrate this holiday. The Israeli blockade and the last wars will not steal our joy.
For merchants, this Eid season has been one of the worst they had in years. Usually during holidays like Eid al-Fitr, sales are high in markets around the world. But in Gaza, shop owners complain of lack of sales.
This has been the most difficult economic condition in over a decade, and people lack the purchasing power. Most people come to the market just to look around, and they hardly buy anything because the economic situation here is very bad. Things are tough, but the spirit of Eid al-Fitr is here, and people will try to make the best of it.
Despite the harsh circumstances, Palestinians in Gaza are preparing themselves to receive Eid al-Fitr holiday like all Muslims around the world.
Eid celebrations in the besieged Gaza Strip will undoubtedly fall short of being full due to the ongoing Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Russia's tensions with the West are threatening to quickly spiral out of control as the war in Ukraine drags on. Immediately after the start of the conflict on February 24th, the U.S. and its allies rushed to the aid of Ukraine. They've imposed sweeping sanctions against Moscow and provided Kiev with military and humanitarian assistance. The size of those shipments and sophistications of the weaponry have been increasingly growing. Besides that, U.S. State and Defense Secretaries recently traveled to Ukraine, promising more military aid.
They need long-range fires. You've heard them express a need for tanks. And we are doing everything that we can to get them the types of support, the types of artillery and munitions that will be effective in this stage of the fight. We're going to push as hard as we can, as quickly as we can, to get them what they need.
What I'm seeing, at least, is that aid is getting here and other distribution points. It's getting out the door incredibly quickly.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is the latest U.S. official to travel to Kiev. there, she promised Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that more help is on the way. Pelosi was referring to a request by President Joe Biden from Congress to pass an aid package to Ukraine. The package is worth $33 billion, with almost two-thirds of it allocated to military aid. That aid includes everything from heavy artillery and armored vehicles to greater intelligence sharing, cyber warfare tools, as well as anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Zelensky, said Paris would step up military and humanitarian support to Ukraine. Those measures by the US and its allies have prompted strong warnings and criticism from Moscow. Russia says the military aid is not only fueling the conflict, but also boosting the risk of direct confrontation between Russia and NATO powers.
The tendency itself to pump weapons, including heavy weapons, to Ukraine and other countries is an action that threatens the security of the continent and provokes instability.
Yet more starkly, the Russian foreign minister has warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war. Sergei Lavrov says NATO is in essence engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kiev with weapons. He has urged the US and NATO to stop sending weapons if they really want to resolve the Ukraine crisis. On the ground in Ukraine, Russia has been targeting foreign weapons. In the latest such move, Moscow says it struck weapons shipments supplied by the US and European countries on an airfield near the southern port city of Odessa. In another sign of escalation, Moscow says dialogue between Russia and the US on strategic stability has been formally frozen. And so as Russia's warnings go unheeded in the West, there's a real risk that the war will spill across Ukraine's borders before it comes to a peaceful resolution inside.
For the first time since the presidential election, the Yellow Vests marched around the country, and most expressed disbelief that Emmanuel Macron was re-elected despite his unprecedented repression of the group.
Frankly, we really don't understand how Macron could be re-elected. We started over purchasing power, and it's worse than ever. I guess people need a knife to their throats to come protest anymore?
They were met by a huge police presence, armed to the teeth. The government continues to intimidate Yellow Vests, but also the average person from rejoining the demonstrations. Intimidating deterrence is also being used to keep journalists from covering the group. In the Yellow Vest demonstration the day before the first round of voting, a journalist from a top French media was fined for allegedly illegally demonstrating while simply reporting on the Yellow Vests.
We'll never stop demanding for citizens' referendums, purchasing power, decent pensions, and the ability to have some money left at the end of the month. After the legislative elections in June and the summer vacation, social unrest will explode this fall.
Thousands of devoted Yellow Vests will continue to turn out every Saturday in Paris alone, and they say others will put their Yellow Vests back on when they see Macron's plans for his second term.
Emmanuel Macron will continue to be the president of the rich and will continue to march. People will eventually recover their good sense and realize the only way to change politics is to join us in the streets.
Nobody expected the Yellow Vests to stop marching. Now we'll see if they can last for the next 5 years.
Global May Day protests will see establishment forces, such as unions and political parties, march nationwide in favor of workers' rights, but also to express major dissatisfaction with the presidential election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As the month of Ramadan is coming to an end, Muslims are gearing up to pick the best clothes to get dressed up for one of their biggest festivities, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. This exhibition gives a glimpse of local costumes of several Muslim countries, from Tunisia and Egypt, all the way to Afghanistan and Iran.
On Eid al-Fitr and other important festivities in Tunisia, men wear this white costume, and women dress like me or the clothes that you see behind me. They are our traditional clothes. The shirt this man is wearing is made from a Syrian cloth called the maskal. It's a famous Syrian cloth that's made out of silk and cotton. Syrian men wear them in celebrations such as weddings and also during our festivities such as Eid al-Fitr.
Aside from showcasing their costumes, the participating nations also get to introduce their Ramadan traditions and what they have for iftar breakfast.
In Syria, it's customary to break our Ramadan fast with our traditional appetizers such as fattoush and tabbouleh. In my city, Aleppo, we start with dairy such as hot milk. Afterwards, we eat the main dish, which varies from a city to the other.
In Afghanistan, we cook our delicious gulani and ashak for Ramadan breakfast. These foods actually are cooked for our dearest guests in other months of the year.
Organized jointly by Iran's Eco Office and the Culture Ministry, the event seeks to bring about a stronger bond between Muslim nations by sharing their cultures and traditions.
Here, Muslims get together to find their commonalities and at the same time learn about their differences. The expo also brought exhibitors coming from ECO member states. The reason we held it in the holy month of Ramadan is to say that despite all our differences, all of us are Muslims and need to unite.
Muslims say Ramadan brings them together more than any other time, since they all practice the same religious tasks throughout the month. And as the call to prayers resonated in the exhibition, all fasting Muslims left the expo for a shared iftar breakfast.
Despite all the differences in languages, costumes, and even Ramadan meals, people here say they feel like they're one nation, since they all come from Muslim countries. And organizers say this is what Ramadan offers, a taste of peace and friendship that transcends all differences. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghanistan, once again facing waves of deadly attacks. In the latest incident, a powerful explosion hit Khalifa Sahib Mosque in the capital, Kabul, killing and injuring dozens of worshippers.
Every Friday, people come to the mosque to say their prayers. Hearing the bomb explosion, I entered the mosque. I am shocked as I'm talking. We took more than 200 casualties to the hospital. It was so horrifying that I had never witnessed such a scene.
Previously, we were falling victim to the US and Taliban war. However, the situation has now changed, but we are still being killed in the mosques and schools. We don't know who are carrying out such blind attacks, but I'm sure the attackers are not Muslims.
Exhausted by growing violence, people of Afghanistan are calling for an end to terror attacks and punishment for the perpetrators.
In my opinion, the recent attacks on specific groups and places show that the enemies of the people of Afghanistan are trying to sow sedition among Muslims and impose another proxy war on Afghans. The Taliban, as new rulers, are obliged to protect Afghans and bring the terrorists to justice.
The international community should take action in ending violence in Afghanistan. They know the roots of terrorist groups or criminal bonds. They should help Afghans with practicing stability. If they are voicing human rights, so why they are watching us falling victim to terrorism?
In the recent days, several large bomb attacks targeted public places in the capital Kabul, Mazar-i-Sharif, and Kunduz provinces. The attacks have taken a scores of lives, mostly from the Hazara community. Bomb attacks in Afghanistan continue as Afghans are observing the holy month of Ramadan. People here believe their enemies are missing no chance to harm innocent Muslims. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The fasting month of Ramadan is over, and Muslims have ushered in the second most important festivity in Islam, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. Muslims start their Eid al-Fitr by taking part in congregational prayers themed with bidding farewell to Ramadan and welcoming the Eid.
Eid al-Fitr is a celebration of our month-long endeavor to connect with God more closely than other times of the year by enduring the hardship of fasting. I'm so happy to be able to fast, and Eid al-Fitr is my reward.
I am so happy to mark Eid al-Fitr, but at the same time I miss the spiritual atmosphere of Ramadan. It's a month when you feel closer to God than ever.
After they complete the Eid al-Fitr prayer, Muslims then visit their relatives and loved ones during the festivity. It's the first time in 2 years that Muslims have marked Eid al-Fitr without COVID curbs, so they can celebrate Eid al-Fitr together.
Over the past 2 years, we were not able to visit the elderly and other relatives. Thanks God, the coronavirus has subsided and we can celebrate Eid al-Fitr with the people we love.
Every year on Eid al-Fitr, Muslims set aside a portion of their annual income, dubbed fitriya, to donate it to the poor. They say this is to spread the happy mood of Eid al-Fitr among the needy.
Zakat al-Fitr is a very small portion of our income, but it makes a significant difference when all affording Muslims join in. This way, the rich and the poor share the festive mood of Eid al-Fitr.
Eid al-Fitr falls on the first day of the lunar month of Shawwal. According to the Islamic lunar calendar, months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the Earth. And the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. Iran sighted the Eid al-Fitr crescent on the eve of Tuesday, while many other Muslim nations announced the festivity on Sunday and Monday.
Eid al-Fitr is a culmination of 1 month of abstinence from eating and drinking. And that's why Muslims consider it a divine reward for their success in obeying God's order. This year, the festive mood is multiplied as Muslims can celebrate it together without the worries of the pandemic. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip rallied on Friday to mark International Quds Day. Millions of people around the world hold rallies every year to mark this day, which takes place on the last Friday of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan, to support the people of Palestine. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded an end to the Israeli occupation. The big event was organized by the Islamic Jihad movement.
Today we mark International Quds Day, while freedom fighters from Gaza, Yemen, Tehran, Lebanon and Syria, as well as in other places around the world, stand united for the sake of Al-Quds.
International Quds Day was declared in 1979 by the founder of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the late Ayatollah Khomeini, to drum up international solidarity for the Palestinian people. People at the rally expressed their gratitude to Imam Khomeini for his historic initiative.
On International Quds Day, we say to the whole world that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of Al-Quds. We also want to express our deepest gratitude to the Islamic Republic of Iran and Imam Khomeini for this important occasion in solidarity with Al-Quds.
Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque have a special place in the hearts of millions of Muslims around the world due to its religious status. Extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in recent days.
Imam Khomeini's designation of this day is of great importance because it unites all resistance fronts for the sake of supporting Palestine and Al-Quds. These fronts are united today more than ever to help secure the liberation of Al-Quds.
International Quds Day is observed in over 80 countries around the globe.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians and has turned a blind eye to the Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
This isn't just some corporate takeover, said one critic, adding, this is about a set of very specific moves that oligarchs have been taking that have gradually concentrated economic, political, and discursive power in fewer and fewer hands. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, A Real Threat to Democracy. Musk buys Twitter for $44 billion. Here's the details. April 25, 2022, rights advocates, public health experts, and media critics were among those who warned that the purchase of Twitter by mega-billionaire Elon Musk, the world's richest person, creates a direct threat to democracy and the common good by putting the outsized power of the social media platform used by hundreds of millions worldwide into the hands of one man. The social media company accepted Musk's offer to purchase Twitter for $44 billion, or $54.20 per share, leading some critics to note other ways the enormous sum of money could have been spent rather than on what Representative Chai Garcia called a vanity project boondoggle to silence Musk's critics. Tax the rich, Garcia said on Twitter. Musk's purchase has led to concern that former President Donald Trump's Twitter account will be reinstated. Trump was banned from the platform in January 2021 after violating its rules by inciting his followers to violently attack the U.S. Capitol in an effort to stop the certification of the 2020 presidential election results. Musk hasn't just purchased another expensive Play Toy, but a global online community that includes about 330 million regular users, said Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of Free Press, adding, with control of such a massive platform comes great responsibility, and Musk hasn't shown he has the capacity to be accountable to this diverse online community. She added, noting Musk's own history of using Twitter to intimidate and disparage others, including journalists, elected officials, owners of competing businesses, and anyone else who might challenge his views. With Musk at the helm, Gonzalez said Twitter must improve its content moderation practices and stop amplifying bigotry and conspiracy theories that pollute public discourse, threaten the health and safety of users, and undermine democracy. Musk has criticized Twitter's efforts to moderate the platform, saying early this month that he believes it's just really important that people have the reality and the perception that they are able to speak freely within the bounds of the law, and that the civilizational risk is decreased the more we can increase the trust of Twitter as a public platform. Journalist Anand Giridharas said that by taking over Twitter and claiming he will protect the platform, as the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated, Musk is doing is what plutocrats have been doing, branding themselves the solution to the very problem they are. This isn't just some corporate takeover, he said, adding, this is about a set of very specific moves that oligarchs have been taking that have gradually concentrated economic, political, and discursive power in fewer and fewer hands. As Media Matters reported recently, right-wing politicians in the U.S. have been in favor of Musk's purchase since he first offered to buy the platform earlier this month. Representative Jim Jordan led 18 House Republicans in writing to Twitter's board of directors demanding that the board preserve all records related to Musk's bid. The right's propagandist had celebrated Musk's bid as a way to garner political gain by ending the company's purported political censorship, reported senior fellow Matt Gaetz, adding, then its elected GOP champions, responding to hesitation from and when Twitter's board raised the prospect of a costly congressional investigation if his offer wasn't accepted. While Twitter was a large and powerful company before Musk's takeover was announced, said Sana Said of Al Jazeera, the purchase does underscore an unnerving trend. The ability of a single man to purchase something that impacts hundreds of millions beyond users in order to influence it in its own image. It's less than great when billionaires own sports teams, which bind communities together as their playthings, said Robert Weisman, president of consumer advocacy group Public Citizen, adding, having a billionaire own Twitter, a vital platform for communication and community, as his plaything, is far more serious. It's a real threat to democracy.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump sponsored the so-called Abraham Accords between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, promising peace nearly 2 years ago. Sudan and Morocco followed their lead shortly afterwards. Since then, Saudi Arabia has been the silent party and the virtual signatory to the normalization process, waiting for the right moment to make its position public. But it seems like the two sides are showing their tendencies for normalization more overtly, with the Israeli President Isaac Herzog openly stating in a recent interview that he wishes to visit the kingdom, calling for normalization with Riyadh. The Israeli president, other than that, has also called for visiting the kingdom. And now word is that the Israeli private plane, an Israeli private plane actually, has also landed in the Saudi capital. In this edition of The Spotlight, we discuss why both Tel Aviv and Riyadh are beating the drums of normalization at this point in time. And we will try to shed light, actually, on the different aspects of this.
Israel and Saudi Arabia have no diplomatic relations, officially. But for years, extensive behind-the-scenes diplomatic and intelligence cooperation between Tel Aviv and Riyadh has been open secret. Now, it seems that curtains are falling off of the covert relationship. Israeli media have revealed that an Israeli aircraft landed in an airport in Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, late on Monday. The private plane reportedly took off from Tel Aviv. But this is not the first time that this has happened. Last October, another Israeli private jet landed in Riyadh, making it the first time a public flight from Israel has ever landed in a kingdom. This is the latest among improving regional ties for Israel after agreements to normalize ties with four nations, namely the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, were reached in the 2020 Abraham Accords. Tel Aviv and Riyadh opened their airspaces to each other in 2020. Apart from that, Israeli and Saudi officials have recently openly talked about normalizing ties. Last month, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said Riyadh does not look at Israel as an enemy. He went on to describe Israel as a potential ally with many common interests. Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud has also recently told a Hebrew language newspaper that the integration of Israel in the region will be a huge benefit not only for Israel, but for the entire region. Israeli President Isaac Herzog on Monday said in an interview that he likes to visit Saudi Arabia openly and called on Riyadh to join the Abraham Accords and normalize its ties with the regime. In November 2020, it was reported that the then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had secretly visited Saudi Arabia. The warming up of ties comes amid the escalation of tensions in the occupied territories. Israel has increased its raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in recent weeks and attacks Palestinian towns and cities almost every day. Palestinians have increased their operations in response to the crackdown. They have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv in the past 2 months, leaving over a dozen Israelis dead. Palestinian response to the previous normalization deals has been clear, that it has not helped the resolution of the long-standing conflict in any meaningful way, and that Israeli brutalities, killings, house demolitions, land grabs and desecration of their sanctities have continued regardless. To them, resistance remains the only path leading to the liberation of the occupied territories.
Now, in order to continue this discussion, we are joined by Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert, who's joining us live from Madison. And also Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist, who's joining us from Molloy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us. Let's begin with Mr. Barrett. Now, the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has openly stated that Riyadh no longer views Tel Aviv as an enemy and has even come to regard the occupying regime as a potential ally. Also, Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud recently welcomed the prospect of Israeli regime's integration into the region. Does this signal normalization ties anytime soon, or are politicians just testing the waters to see if the time is right?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't have any inside information allowing me to answer it. But what I can say is that when Saudi Arabia threatens to essentially embrace the genocidal Zionist entity and thereby endorse the destruction of Palestine, the desecration of the world's oldest, most important Islamic architectural monument, the Masjid al-Aqsa, which the Zionists are planning to demolish so they can build a blood sacrifice temple, this is complete treason to the Islamic world. It's one thing when countries like Sudan and Morocco and so on off at the peripheries commit this kind of treason. It's unfortunate, but it doesn't go to the heart of things in terms of the Muslim Ummah. But the Saudis are the usurpers who claim to be protecting the Haramain, the crucial center of Islamic worship. And they're therefore obliged to defend Islam, which is under attack by the Zionists. The Zionists declared war on the religion of Islam and all Muslims in the world when they invaded and occupied and committed genocide in Palestine, which has been Muslim-administered holy land for all three Abrahamic religions essentially ever since Islam existed. So this is sheer treason, and it's going, if it happens, if this normalization goes through, every Muslim on earth is going to have to go to war with these usurping bandits in Riyadh.
Exactly. And Mr. Terrell, one of the reasons Saudi Arabia has so far preferred to stay in the shadows is the fact that it was the only Arab country whose name is associated with the peace initiative that was adopted as a pan-Arab idea for permanent peace. What has changed now for the Saudis? Why don't they see any reason to hide their true intentions?
Well, I think the as a peace activist, of course, I would love to be able to celebrate people getting together and talking and settling their differences, if that's what this is. But I think that this is more akin to rival gangs sitting down and dividing the spoils and setting their turfs. The word normalization that's been said over and over again at present would be to normalize a intolerable criminal situation that should not be allowed to continue. The normalization of relations between these countries and Israel is not only normalizing the continued occupation of Palestine, but it's normalizing the violence that's been seen, especially these last days, normalizing war and oppression, and it's normalizing conditions in Saudi Arabia and in Bahrain that are making hell for the life of the people who live in those countries as well. I think this is any plea for peace, any agreements need to be made not by the princes and the oligarchs and the warlords. We just saw that in the Doha talks that happened about Afghanistan, where the people most affected by the talks that the Taliban and the United States government had were not represented, were not at the table. Any kind of peace talks, any kind of agreement, and Prime Minister Herzog the other day invited not just the Saudis to join the accords, but the Abrahamic family to join the family. It's being placed as a family, but the Palestinians don't have a voice there. The people of Yemen don't have a voice there. The common people of Saudi Arabia and the common people of Bahrain and the UAE, who are very politically repressed, who have suffered under tremendous human rights abuses themselves, have no place at this table. So I think what we're seeing is a normalization of a violent, very scary kind of situation. And it's going to be for the people who are running Saudi Arabia, for the people who are running Israel, for the arms dealers, this will be, this may be a very happy event. And but for the people living in these regions, for the common folk, they have nothing to celebrate from this.
Exactly. They don't have anything to celebrate. And whenever we talk about Israel, it's just indispensable to talk about the U.S. So, Mr. Barrett, the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. has said, and I'm quoting him, it would be very important for our region if the U.S. and Saudi Arabia were to fix their relationship. Why is it so important?
Well, it seems that the Saudis currently have managed to get some distance between themselves and Washington, D.C. in general, and the Biden regime in particular. The Saudis were in the pocket of Trump, or vice versa, I guess, during the Trump administration. And the Trump administration made all kinds of moves that are perhaps somewhat correctly, or at least understandably, viewed as totally insane by the majority of imperial strategists here in the belly of the beast. And so the Biden administration is not so enthusiastic about these Zionist extremist projects. It would not have put the U.S. Embassy in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. It wouldn't have totally 100% endorsed and normalized the occupation. And it certainly wouldn't have pushed these idiotic so-called Abraham Accords on the region. So there's a difference in thinking between the lunatic neoconservatives around Trump, people like Pompeo and Bolton, and the really almost equally bad people, but slightly more sophisticated and slightly more rational people around Biden. So there's that issue. The Israelis, I think, are now signaling that they're all in on the war on Ukraine. We just had this brouhaha over the supposed anti-Semitism of the totally reasonable thing said by Lavrov. And that's a signal that the Israelis are jumping on board with the Ukraine bandwagon. And they would probably like to do that as part of a imperial alliance. Zionists are actually the senior partners, not the junior partners, in the imperial alliance of the Anglo-Zionist Empire, the NATO states. That's because they have such important people, key finance people, and people owning the journalism industry throughout the West. So the Zionists want to keep the empire together on the same page, and they want their absurd Trumpian extremism to be the order of the day and recognized even by the relatively more reasonable, at least on that issue, people in D.C. So the Zionists, I guess, are trying to rally the so-called fake West, this alleged collective, whether they call it the collective international community or whatever, that's really just the Anglo-Zionist empire run by oligarchs who are predominantly, or at least disproportionately, ethnically Jewish, these billionaires who are primarily loyal to Israel and then are willing to be semi-loyal to those countries that slavishly serve Israel's interests, like the entire all of Western Europe, the United States, Canada, and Australia. And so they want to keep that empire together and on the same radical Zionist page. And unfortunately, they may succeed.
So in other words, you're saying that the Israelis are concerned that tensions between the Biden administration and Saudi Arabia might push the Saudis towards Russia and China and even maybe better relations with Iran. Why do you think they would want to counter that?
Well, that's a step towards the end of the empire's dreams of conquering the entire world. I mean, what we're seeing right now in the war on Russia, which is what the supposed invasion of Ukraine really is, it's a NATO war of aggression against Russia, is an attempt to pick off one of the three key links in this new emerging multipolar world of China, Russia, and Iran. China is the biggest. Iran is the most principled and the pioneer of pushing for a sovereign, independent, multipolar world. And now Russia is the one with all of the nuclear weapons and the military prowess. And so the Americans are trying to destroy the Russian wing of this multipolar alliance. At one point, we thought they would go after Iran first. And then at another point, we thought they might be going after China. And they, of course, they did when they attacked China with the COVID strike in Wuhan. That's another story. But yeah, they're afraid that the Saudis might drift out of this empire, make friends with the Russians and the Chinese. And the Israelis don't want that because they know this Western empire is what keeps their Zionist project going.
Okay, so Mr. Terrell, how do you think Israelis are going to try and counter that? What are the strategies that they might have in mind?
I don't know that the situation is as sophisticated as all of that. I think that Israel is certainly wanting to maintain its hold on Palestine and its place of power in the region. But I think as far as the United States is concerned, I think it's just almost pure business. Anything that can stock, that can stir the pot, anything that can raise more money for the weapons manufacturers, totally divorced from ideology or any kind of big plan. It's making a quick buck right now, and anything that can make for more war and more disorder is what the United States is trying to do. The space, the distance between the Biden administration and the Saudis has been totally rhetorical. I mean, this was President Biden, as a candidate, mouthed what all the civilized world is saying about the Saudi war on Yemen, and used all the words that the rest of us use about a humanitarian disaster and a war crime, and insisted it was all going to stop. His first address public address on foreign relations promised that the aid to Saudi, the military aid and arms sales to Saudi Arabia would stop. And immediately, you know, within months, there was billions of dollars worth of weapons from Raytheon that were sold to the Saudis. So I think that's just a cover. And I think all of this too, if there were an accord, if there were a meeting of the leaders of these countries that actually was going to bring about permanent peace, I think the United States would certainly be on the behest of the arms manufacturers. They would sabotage that. They wouldn't let that happen for a minute. This is not a matter of permanent peace. You know, this is our, I'm afraid, our country's bent on normalizing permanent war, wars that are not supposed to, you know, clearly not supposed to be ever ended or settled or even won, but to be continuous. And I think that the Ukraine situation now is offering a huge opportunity for the military-industrial complex that the United States is not going to miss, not let it go by.
Very interesting point you mentioned that, because the so-called Abraham Accords claimed to be about peace. Mr. Barrett, how successful have they been in bringing peace to the occupied territories in particular, especially keeping in mind the atrocities of Israelis against the Palestinian worshippers just a few weeks ago in Al-Aqsa Mosque?
Well, these so-called Abraham Accords, which really have nothing to do with the Abrahamic religions, what they are is a dirty deal between Zionist gangsters and the gangsters running a handful of these other countries in the region. And they're not successful they haven't been successful at all in bringing peace. On the contrary, it's been bloody business as usual in occupied Palestine as the repression continues unabated. There's been no change whatsoever in the existential genocidal war on the Palestinian people by the Zionists. And this is kind of surprising, even to me. I mean, I'm cynical, and I knew that the Saudis and their partners in crime were probably being mostly rhetorical when they said that as we're coming into these accords, you know, we're expecting that the Zionists will start making steps towards peace with the Palestinians, blah, blah, blah. But nothing in that direction has happened, nothing whatsoever. There hasn't been the slightest move of one micrometer towards peace from the Zionist side in Palestine. If anything, they're accelerating their genocide just throughout the entire holy month of Ramadan, which just ended, and Eid Mubarak to everyone. The Zionists were brutally attacking worshipers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque on a regular basis. They were shooting people down and killing several Palestinians a day, as they always do. None of this has slowed, and there's been no move to come up with any even reasonable framework for actual peace in Palestine. So this whole idea that it's a peace agreement is a complete joke. And I agree with the other guests that a lot of the impetus for this horrible situation is the military-industrial complex and the folks who are making money off it, I think we have to keep in mind that there is also a strategic dimension to that. That is the reason that the empire is constantly at war and willing to let the arms manufacturers help push this policy of perpetual war and destruction, is that it serves the strategic interests of the empire, because right now the rest of the world is catching up with the West in terms of economic output and technology and productivity. And if everything continues in that vein, the Western empire will be eclipsed within a couple of decades at most. So they have to destroy, they have to kill, they have to stop the global economy from growing, they have to spread COVID and attack China and Wuhan with COVID, they have to start World War III in Ukraine, they need to blow up the planet and kill and kill and kill in order to prevent the eclipse of the unipolar empire and the rise of a multipolar empire. That's the strategic plan behind the apparent profiteering of the military-industrial complex, which just seems to be running everything so it can make money. No, there is a strategic plan behind it, and it's an evil one.
So, Mr. Tara, I can see that you agree with Mr. Barrett. If you could please elaborate, what do you think is the true nature of these Abraham Accords? Is it more about building an anti-Iran coalition and sidelining the oppressed Palestinians, maybe?
Yeah, it's about sidelining not only the people, the Palestinians, but the people of Bahrain and the people of Saudi Arabia, the people of Yemen. It's to call this a peace accord is really obscene. It's a plan for, again, maintaining, for normalizing what should never be normal, what should never be tolerated at all. I think that, too, we're on the edge of, I agree with some of what the other guests said, and I think that we're at a very, very scary time, and rather than lose this empire, which is, we're willing to risk all life on Earth. We're closer to a nuclear war, according to the bulletin of the atomic scientists now, than we ever were during the Cold War. And in recent years, we've had both the United States, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in a paper released in 2019, was touting the new nuclear weapons that are being produced here as being more flexible, more easily deployable, and saying that with these new nuclear weapons, the United States can be able to prevail on the battlefield. The whole notion of mutually assured destruction, the sword of Damocles, as President Kennedy called it, over all of our heads, threatening us every day, whatever kind of protection that may have given us over the years, we have now, there isn't, the mutually assured destruction is not mutually assured anymore. We have the United States, and then now Russia has, just in recent months, been talking about raising the idea that perhaps they could win a nuclear war. This absolutely insane idea that a nuclear war can be winnable, which no one suggested that for many, many years, for decades, has reemerged. And I think this may be a the world headed toward destruction, rather than as the other guest said, rather than give up the unipolar hegemony, we'd rather end the whole thing. And it's a very, very frightening time, and we need real peace accords. We need real people sitting down and not sidelining the big issues, yes, if only the Saudis and Israel and UAE and Bahrain could be sitting down with the United States and with Russia and with Iran and be talking about what would be a just solution. But we're not doing that. That's not what's happening.
Exactly, Mr. Tarra. I'm sorry, we're running out of time. I had to cut you off. That was Mr. Brian Tarra, political commentator and peace activist out of Malloy, and Kevin Barrett, author and a Middle East expert out of Madison. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen.